there and to assess human capabilities. UNEF offered the Spec Ops people for TV interviews. They trusted super-disciplined special forces types not to say the wrong thing during an interview. Me? They mostly wanted me to keep my mouth shut. Come on, Sergeant, a Boston TV reporter asked after they turned the mics off. You guys coming back is the biggest story since the Kristang here got wiped out. You have to give us something, she said with a perfect smile. The station must have figured that an attractive woman would be better able to get me to talk than any of the male reporters. I shrugged. I'm sorry, ma'am. There is just not much for me to tell, and my role on the ship was to support the Special Forces teams. They got all the fun training, and you know I can't talk about that. She glanced at the cameraman. I understand. One last question, then. And as she said that, I noticed the cameraman turn the camera back on. Probably activated her mic also. We've heard rumors that some people have been referring to you as Colonel Bishop. Why is that? Damn. Unfortunately, the PR people with UNEF had prepared me in case someone else slipped up about my temporary rank. Apparently someone had. I laughed. That was a joke aboard the ship, ma'am. It's an honorary title. I'm no more a colonel than Colonel Sanders is. She looked disappointed. I wasn't. My parents' house looked great. They had the house to themselves again, although there was still a family living in the converted garage. As the economy improved, housing conditions were going back to normal. My parents still had chickens, but they'd sold their cows. The garden looked great. I think they kept such a large garden because it gave my father something to do, rather than driving my mom crazy. No deer fencing, Dad? I asked, surprised.
The deer population around here got about hunted out during the bad times, Joe, my father explained. We had a pair of Jehovah's Witnesses come by the house a month back. Your mother suggested we put them to work. Nobody wants to come near them, he chuckled.
Doing what? I asked, knowing that I was walking right into his joke.
Deer repellent. Nobody wants to come near them, he chuckled. And I laughed too.
A couple days later, during breakfast at my parents' house, I was enjoying a hot, fresh cup of coffee and surfing news on my father's tablet. A lot had happened on Earth while the merry band of pirates had been away. First, I checked sports news. The NFL was up to 47 days without a player being arrested. That had to be a new record. There was the usual political BS. I skipped over that. Business. The world economy was on the verge of roaring back. Tech companies were pumped about the prospect of reverse engineering Kristang technology, assuming they could ever figure out how any of it worked. Maybe I could get a shiny beer can I knew to give us a hint. Unlikely, but I had to try it. What else was in the news? Crap. Double crap. First, I had spit hot coffee on myself, the kitchen table, and my toast. Second, the reason I'd spit out the coffee was because I had taken a sip just before reading an article on the internet. Some formerly homeless guy in Vegas had won $3 million over 2 days, hitting up 5 casinos before they all banned him. He had been playing blackjack, and despite the best surveillance by state-of-the-art casino security, there had been no evidence that this guy had been card-counting or cheating in any way. In fact, based on interviews, it appeared he wasn't quite clear on the rules of blackjack. According to the article, it had been an incredible run of luck. Monkeys, of course, had no idea what luck really is. Joey, is everything all right? My mother asked, handing me a napkin so I could blot up the coffee that was soaking my formerly crisp rye toast. Yes, Mom. I need to make a quick phone call, I said, as I picked up the coffee cup and a piece of toast, giving her a kiss on my way out the door. It was misting rain, so I stood on the front porch. Putting in my Z-phone earpiece, I made a call. Oh, Skippy, I need to speak with you, please.
Sure thing, Joe.
What is it? He asked with a too innocent tone to his voice. It was almost certain that he had been monitoring my web browsing, so he knew exactly what I had been reading.
There's a funny thing I want to ask you about. Some guy in Vegas won a ton of money playing blackjack.
You don't say. Skippy's tone was not convincing. He needed to work on that. Hold a minute. Let me scan the internet for pertinent news.
Yep. Yep, I see it now. Wow, that is amazing. You never know, huh? What a lucky guy. That's why Vegas is the land where dreams can come true, I guess. Amazing.
Yeah, that's one word for it, I said, biting into soggy toast. You wouldn't, know anything about this, would you? I'm only asking because you are an incredibly amoral, sneaky little beer can.
Joe, that hurt. Although perhaps amoral is accurate, since what happened in Vegas was neither moral nor immoral.
Uh-huh, that's debatable. So you were not involved in any way?
Involved is such a vague word, Joe. Aren't we all involved with each other? At the quantum level, everything is...
You know what I meant, Skippy. I will ask a very direct, non-vague question. Did you help this guy rip off 5 casinos?
This guy? You mean a Navy veteran who had medical problems and had fallen on hard times?
Mr. Ronald Brown certainly deserved a run of good luck in his life. I'm surprised at you, Joe. Considering that you are a soldier, I would think you should be happy to see a veteran enjoying good fortune.
Don't try to change the subject. I am happy for Mr. Brown. What I am not happy about is the good fortune part. It's not luck when you're cheating, Skippy.
Cheating? Evening the odds somewhat can't be considered cheating, Joe. Casinos always have the advantage in blackjack. If a player starts to win, the casino can end the game by shutting down the table. The only way for a player to even the odds is to do the same as the house. Walk away from the table. Walk away before the game begins.
The house always has their thumb on the scale. What was wrong with me helping an average guy do the same thing?
Aha! So you did do it then.
Damn it, he muttered. How in the hell do you ever manage to outsmart me?
Joe, when something like that happens, I sense a great disturbance in the force. Your guilty conscience tripped you up, Skippy.
Ha! That is a good one, Joe. No freaking way would I ever feel guilty about this. What did I do wrong?
You ripped off 5 casinos, Skippy.
Pfft! He made a raspberry sound. Like they're ever going to miss that paltry amount of money. Besides, technically I did a huge favor to those casinos, to the entire gaming industry. In fact, they should be thanking me.
Okay. Man, this I have to hear.
What convoluted logic was he going to dream up for this one?
Go ahead. Try to spin your way out of this one. It should be amusing.
Amusing? You mean instructive, right?
Joe, the entire gaming industry is based on conning gullible people into getting ripped off when they know they are going to get ripped off. If all the mooks out there used their monkey brains, Vegas would go out of business in a week. Casinos need to give people fantasy, the fantasy that somehow they, against all odds, will win. The fantasy that losing is for other people, not them. There are millions of suckers across the USA and beyond who will read that article about Ronald Brown winning millions. They will want to cash out their savings, pack up the car, and take a road trip to Vegas, baby. Because if Ronald Brown did it, it can happen to them too.
Seriously, Joe, I've been monitoring communications of casino executives, and they're all playing this up for maximum publicity. They're leaking to the media that they banned Ron from playing their tables because Ron has a secret system for winning at blackjack.
Every sucker out there thinks he or she has a secret system, too, and the casino execs know those people will be flocking to their casino soon. So, everybody wins. Except the suckers, of course. Nothing I can do about them.
I mused. Bottom line, then, you did this to help. Out of the goodness of your chrome-plated heart.
Hopefully the tone of my voice reflected sarcasm.
Exactly. Well, that plus I'm bored, Joe.
Ah, man. I took a sip of coffee and looked out at the softly drizzling rain. The forecast called for the rain to go away by noon and become a nice, sunny day.
Skippy, last time we were here, you chatted with, like, billions of people. Didn't that keep you occupied?
Yes, and I'm doing that now.
Joe, I could carry on simultaneous conversations with every human on this planet and not use more than 2% of my processing capacity. Way less than 2%, in fact. I need a challenge. Because of enforced inactivity, I have already had to put most of me into dormancy. It would not do for me to get into mischief.
Would not do? If ripping off casinos didn't meet Skippy's definition of mischief, then I was afraid to see how much trouble he could get into.
Please, please, do not get into any more trouble, Skippy.
I'm not sure I can promise that, Joe.
Oh, and hey, I'm sure you are too busy to read stories about interesting things that happened at casinos in Hong Kong, Monaco, and other places over the past couple days, right? No need for you to trouble yourself about such trivial matters. Also,
You don't play daily fantasy sports, so, don't pay attention to that either. Although some guy named Stippy is totally cleaning up there. Oh, I have created a monster. If UNEF found out about Skippy's larcenous adventures, I was going to be in serious hot water. It was not my decision to stop at this miserable mud ball you call home again, Skippy pointed out. You know how easily I get bored. Fine. Can you give me a few days to think up something interesting for you to do? While I doubt you will find a way to entertain me, sure, I'll give you 5 days. Great. No pressure on me. Now I needed to save Earth from Skippy. Paradise. To seek glory in battle is glorious again emerged high above the planet's southern continent, although this time not as far from the surface as before. Indeed, the little frigate was below the altitude at which it could safely jump away, a fact that greatly concerned the ship's crew and captain. When the mission had been explained to the crew, the captain had been forced to reassure them that the Glory, its crew, and its captain were not out of favor with the task force commander. Quite the opposite was true. The little ship had been so bold and so successful in its previous missions that Glory had earned the honor of becoming the lead ship of the raiding force. The crew should be immensely proud, the captain had declared. The crew's justifiable pride was tempered by their intimate knowledge of Kristang culture and their well-informed understanding of the military situation in the battle space around the planet Perdassus. They knew the Glory's boldness and success were not the only, or even most important, reasons their ship now had the honor of another high-risk raiding mission. The key factors why they were once again risking their lives, while the other task force ships safely drifted in deep space, were unspoken, but known to everyone aboard the frigate. Glory was a frigate, the type of ship most numerous in the Kristang fleet. Frigates made up the bulk of the fleet because such ships were cheap and quick to construct, and they did not require large crews. A frigate could carry the same type of missiles as a battleship, although much less of them, and some frigates were even outfitted with a railgun, every bit as potent as the railguns of a larger combatant. What frigates lacked were heavy shields and the ability to carry more than a dozen missiles. Frigates also rarely were equipped with energy-draining damping fields, both because the reactors of most frigates could not generate sufficient power, and because any frigate foolish enough to get close enough to an enemy to use a damping field was usually soon a dead frigate. So, the crew of the Glory knew they had earned the honor of another raid, mostly because their ship was among the most expendable of the task force's few ships. The other reason was deception, to conceal the true size of the Kristang task force. Each starship broadcast a unique jump drive signature, and by now the Ruhar were very familiar with the signature of the Glory. To rotate raiding duties among multiple frigates would eventually tell the Ruhar how many ships were in the Kristang task force. The purpose of sending a destroyer on the last raid was not just because a destroyer's heavier weapons could cause more damage on the surface. It was also to force the Ruhar to devote more ships to the defense. A mere little frigate could be dealt with by one defender. Chasing away a destroyer required a prudent commander to commit at least 2 or 3 ships. That prior raid had been entirely successful. The destroyer had inflicted significant damage to Ruhar facilities on the surface. Both the Glory and the destroyer, we are proud to honor Clan Subleaner Rosh Atal Vergent, who inspires us every day, had gathered vital intelligence about Ruhar defense tactics and capabilities, and the raid had forced the defending Ruhar ships to pull closer to the planet, concentrating above the vital northern continent. Of the known Ruhar ships defending the battle space around Perdassus, several were now stationed at such low altitude they could not quickly jump from their positions. That left only 3 ships capable of freely maneuvering to quickly intercept raiders. All that was good. And the Glory's crew did feel prideful when they were not wondering how many raids they could conduct before the odds caught up with them. None of them, not even the captain, were from families sufficiently high-ranking to warrant a troop ship being named for them after their deaths. All the pride in the galaxy would be cold comfort after a Ruhar weapon penetrated their thin defenses and exploded the Glory's reactor. So it was with a great amount of unspoken fear among its crew that the frigate emerged above the southern continent and immediately began boosting at full power for greater altitude. The frigate had emerged below jump altitude in order to provide a tempting target for the Ruhar defenders, but the ship's captain had no desire for a suicide mission. Although the task force's support ships carried equipment for maintaining jump drives, it was inevitable the drive would slowly decay and fall out of calibration on a predictable curve without service at a full space dock. Already, the Glory's drive was operating at only 92% efficiency, and that increased the distance the ship would have to climb away from the planet in order for a successful jump. As the frigate frantically clawed its way out of the planet's gravity well, with the crew considering throwing things overboard to lighten the ship, its maser cannon began firing rearward at the southern continent. Tuned so the beam covered a broader area of the surface, it shifted from one target to another. Targets were scattered across the surface, and the maser was pointed at areas without heavy cloud cover to maximize the destructive energy delivered to the surface. Although the targets were widely spaced apart, they were all of the same type. Fields of human crops. The maser beam scorched wherever it struck, burning out entire fields and withering plants that were close to where the searing beam struck. Humans in the fields died. Others who were lucky to receive Z-phone warnings after the initial strike scrambled to get undercover. The Ruhar commander waited perhaps too long before dispatching one of his high guard ships to chase the frigate away. He had been wary of another enemy trick, and wary of another tongue-lashing from the planetary chief administrator if another raid struck the northern continent. If he had acted sooner, he might have caught the enemy frigate before it jumped away. He did note with interest that the frigate waited until it had climbed beyond minimum jump distance before it disappeared. The Ruhar sensor network detected telltale signs of a deteriorating jump drive. That was an interesting fact that he would file away for later use. For the immediate moment, he needed to answer a call from the deputy administrator, who had received a harsh communication from the human expeditionary force leader. Over 40 humans had died in the attack, an attack which the Ruhar defenses had done little to stop. If such attacks continued, the human leader warned, the ability of humans to feed themselves would be in doubt, and the Ruhar lacked enough nutrient mush to feed the human population for more than a few weeks. The Ruhar on Gitanu also lacked the facilities to produce more food for humans, which means more would need to be shipped in at great expense, and at great risk, for a ceasefire in the sector was still being negotiated. Bringing in food for the humans would require several large cargo ships. Those ships would need to be escorted by warships, and those warships would have to be diverted from urgent combat duties. The Ruhar fleet commander thought to himself that his dreams of stationing his ships at Gitanu would be a pleasant, if brief, respite from combat, were fading away with each successful enemy raid. Earth. The next day, both of my parents were at work, so I had the place to myself. To keep busy, I went out to the barn where my father had been working on the tractor. While I was fixing the brakes, Skippy called me. "Hey, Joe, I need your help with something." "You need my help." I wiped my hands on a rag. "Since when?" "Now I sense a great disturbance in the force." "Since now. The idiots at UNEF have assigned a diplomat to negotiate with me over bringing that troop ship back. The guy is seriously irritating me, and I want you to talk to him before I do something he might regret."
"Skippy, the correct expression is before I do something that I might regret."
There was a distinct pause before he responded. "We may have another communication problem here. What I'm talking about, Joe, is laying a serious smackdown on a jerk who is pushing the limits of my patience. I wouldn't regret doing that at all. Hell, I'd buy a ticket to see something like that. Now, he will very much regret it if he pushes me over the edge." How do I explain human expression to an alien AI? "The expression means that you might regret overreacting, might regret doing something you later realize was going too far for the situation." "Damn, your human expressions are so confusing. Anyway, as Hannibal Smith of the A-Team said, overkill is underrated." It still amazed me that Skippy took so many cultural references from crappy TV shows. "It's an idiom, Skippy. You know what an idiom is, right?"
"Sure.
An idiom is something idiots say, instead of saying what they really mean." This conversation wasn't going anywhere, I decided. "All right, who is this diplomat?" "I've been calling him Chuckles the Clown." There was no way for me to suppress laughing at that. "Chuckles the Clown. It is appropriate. His real name is something like Charles Winthrop Douchebag the Third. I shortened Charles to Chuck and then, well, you'll understand when you talk to him. Hey, I'm calling him now."
Hello?
A voice said. Then there was the sound of a phone hitting a tile floor.
Oh, blast it,
the voice said, followed by the distinctive sound of a toilet flushing. Skippy, I whispered. You called this guy while he is in the freaking bathroom? In negotiations, throwing your opponent off balance is a time-honored practice, he answered smugly.
Why won't this bloody thing turn off? The voice said with a British accent. Heidi-ho there, Chuckles. It's me, Skippy the Magnificent, and Colonel Joe Bishop is on the line also. Say hello, Joe.
Hello, Mr. What was his last name? I was pretty sure it wasn't exactly Douchebag, but maybe it wasn't Winthrop either.
Winthrop. Charles Winthrop.
To my ear, he said it like Bond, James Bond. Pleased to meet you, Mr. Winthrop, I said politely.
Likewise, Sergeant Bishop. I have been very impressed.
Hey, Skippy broke in. He is Colonel Bishop to you, Chuckles. Skippy, it's all right, I said quickly. It was no surprise that negotiations with our alien AI friend had not been going well. I'm a sergeant down here, and I'm proud to be a sergeant. Mr. Winthrop, Skippy tells me you have been attempting to negotiate his help in bringing the Krestang troopships back into Earth orbit.
That is correct, Mr. Bishop, he said.
His diplomatic training must have told him that calling me Mr. was better than Sergeant.
We have made several generous offers, Skippy broke in again. I have considered your most generous offers.
That was sarcasm, in case you need a translation. The answer is no, and hell no. As a diplomat, Winthrop surely expected that no was merely the beginning of negotiations. He didn't know Skippy the way I did. Smoothly, calmly, he continued,
Mr. Skippy, I am sure that through good faith negotiations we can reach a compromise that both parties can accept.
Hey, Chuckles, Skippy interrupted. Why don't we take a break while you find a dictionary somewhere? Look up the word negotiation. I'll give you a hint. Negotiations occur when each side has something the other side wants. The power dynamics in negotiations affect the outcome, because the party who needs what the other side has is the most willing to make concessions. The power dynamic in this case is that you, meaning humans, absolutely must get what I have. What I have is a way for humanity to be warned of and possibly prevent hostile alien ships from coming to Earth. Your failure to secure my assistance in these negotiations, yes, I was using verbal air quotes there, would be disastrous for your species. I'm talking fire, brimstone, railguns, pounding your cities into dust, all kinds of traditional biblical-type apocalypse stuff. Except, maybe not plagues of locusts. I have never known the Krestang or the Theranin to use clouds of insects as a weapon. Although there's a first time for everything, right? Anyway, back to the subject. You, on the other hand, have something I am only, mildly interested in. If a fleet of outrageously pissed-off aliens comes to Earth and wipes out you humans, I can go dormant and wait for the cockroaches to evolve. Mr. Winthrop, Skippy, I attempted to explain, has kind of a thing about cockroaches replacing us as the dominant species on Earth. Skippy snorted.
If Chuckles the clown here keeps trying to negotiate with me instead of getting to the freaking point, then clearly cockroaches are moving up the ladder by default. You had better start welcoming your new cockroach overlords now, Joe.
Chuckles lost some of his carefully practiced diplomatic cool. I could hear his voice tighten.
Mr. Skippy, surely you understand that...
By contrast, Skippy's voice was cheery. I surely understand that I have no incentive to negotiate with you or anyone about anything. You monkeys need me. I don't need you for anything.
Mr. Skippy, you assuredly do not need our help. Our assistance would be, as you stated, merely a convenience. Our need for you is similarly not an absolute. We are capable of sending a team up to retrieve that troop ship,
Winthrop responded frostily.
What we propose is an agreement to provide convenience to both parties.
Oh, sure, Skippy snorted. You could send up a tin can to rendezvous with that ship eventually. You won't be able to get in, though.
This is very embarrassing to admit. Joe locked the keys in it.
I told Joe that we should hide a spare set of keys near the reactor, but did he listen to me?
No,
big stupid head.
You could have an astronaut try jimmying the door open with a coat hanger, I suppose.
Chuckles laughed. Whether he was genuinely amused at my expense, or his diplomatic training told him when it was appropriate to laugh, I couldn't tell. While he was laughing, I took the opportunity to interject a comment. Mr. Winthrop, I appreciate that you must be under tremendous pressure to reach an agreement. Based on my extensive and close experience with the ancient alien superintelligence we call Skippy, I described him that way to remind Chuckles who he was attempting to negotiate with. That is simply never going to happen. Skippy is right. We do not have any leverage with him. Our taking the Dutchman back out is a convenience to him. But he has waited millions of years already. He kind of really can wait another million years if we piss him off. He knows that we can't wait to send our pirate ship out again. There could be another Theranan ship on its way here right now. Skippy knows that. I'm sorry, but I think UNEF has put you in an impossible situation here.
Thank you for the frank assessment, Mr. Bishop. Chuckle's voice was smooth again. Perhaps we should all consider the situation and resume this discussion at an opportune time in the future. That would be a good idea.
Skippy surprised me by saying that. Then he went back to being his usual self.
For the sake of efficiency, when we resume the discussions, instead of you contacting me, how about you talk to yourself in a mirror? That way you won't waste any more of my time and avoid the consequences of me getting seriously annoyed at you. Or if you don't want to talk to a mirror, you can use a sock puppet.
Winthrop had regained his balance and smoothly responded.
Clearly your time is extremely valuable, Mr. Skippy. Mr. Bishop, perhaps it would be better if you and I spoke directly.
Ah, crap. If UNEF had assigned Winthrop to negotiate with Skippy, the next step would be ordering me to work with him. This was going to ruin my whole freaking week, at least, and there was no way for me to avoid it. Winthrop would make a politely worded request to UNEF Command, and they would contact the U.S. Army, and the Army would order me to help Chuckles the Clown.
Certainly, sir. It would probably be best for you to go through my commanding officer.
Except that I had no idea who my current CO was. The 10th Infantry Division was stuck on Paradise, as far as I knew. When they promoted me to colonel, I was temporarily attached to a headquarters unit, and I reported to a general who was still on Paradise, as far as I knew. Actually, my unknown chain of command could buy me an extra day of freedom. I was wrong about an extra day of freedom, because Major Sims called me that same night. We had seen each other only twice since we landed. Both of us had been stuck in debriefings. We had texted via Z-phone, but that's all. Sims had good news and bad news for me. The good news is that she had recommended me for a Bronze Star, but she had been told that since my meritorious action had occurred during an aerial flight, the paperwork had been changed to a Distinguished Flying Cross for my solo space dive. Because our mission was secret, I wouldn't be able to wear either medal on Earth. But it was a nice gesture. On the other hand, I had been recommended for a medal before in Nigeria, and nothing had come of it. The bad news was that my leave was cancelled, effective immediately. I had to drive down to Bangor that night. An Air Force transport would be flying me back to Wright-Patterson. UNEF Command had thought about the situation and decided the Dutchman needed to go back out ASAP. That made me wonder if their foreheads hurt from slapping themselves over such an obvious decision.
Chapter 4. Paradise. To seek glory in battle is glorious, jumped in above Lemuria again. This time the little frigate emerged at a high enough altitude that it could immediately jump away if needed. The ship's crew was increasingly anxious. Each time they raided the planet, they were certain this time would be their last. The Kristang Task Force had lost one ship early in the raiding campaign. A frigate had been caught in a damping field by two Ruhar destroyers and blown apart in spectacular fashion. Some in the task force, including the Glory's captain, thought the now-dead ship had pushed its luck and been showing off, hoping to impress the task force commander. All that foolish ship had accomplished was to provide the hated Ruhar with a morale boost and place a greater burden on the remaining ships in the task force. The Glory's mission on this particular raid was to test how the Ruhar would react to an enemy ship burning crops of the humans, to test whether the Ruhar would react at all, if they cared in any way about human crop losses and the potential for widespread starvation. The last time the Glory had jumped in to target the southern continent, the frigate's mission had been hoping to lure Ruhar ships away from the northern continent again. The Ruhar had fallen for the trick the first time, and paid a price when a Kristang destroyer jumped in and struck several important sites on the northern continent. The second time, the Ruhar had been more cautious. From what little the Kristang had been able to decrypt from Ruhar messages, the Commodore of the Ruhar ships was under heavy pressure to defend the Ruhar population and facilities. How much damage would the Ruhar allow the Kristang to inflict on the humans before the Ruhar sent ships to chase the Kristang away? How many ships would the Ruhar Commodore send, and what tactics would he use? Bringing back answers to those questions was the true purpose of this raid. Any damage inflicted on the traitorous humans would be a bonus. It would serve the humans right if they starved to death. If they were truly honorable warriors, they should have fought the Ruhar to the last man. Instead, they laid down their weapons like cowards and meekly became farm laborers. To seek glory in battle is glorious, set its maser cannon on broad spectrum and began methodically burning out fields of human crops. Wherever the maser touched, crops withered and died, all moisture boiled away by the scorching beam. To the surprise of the frigate's captain, a full 7 minutes went by before the Ruhar Commodore sent a single frigate to deal with the intruder. The Glory had been maneuvering randomly to dodge unenthusiastic maser and railgun fire from the Ruhar before the defending frigate jumped in. To show the Ruhar that the warrior Kristang were not afraid in the least, the Glory stood its ground for 20 seconds, exchanging fire with the enemy frigate, then jumped away. Its mission had been entirely successful, and large swaths of the southern continent lay in waste. Precious human crops had been destroyed, and valuable intelligence about the tactics and capabilities of the Ruhar had been gathered. That night, the Glory's crew would feast deservedly. Earth. My father drove me down to Bangor right after we finished dinner. On the way down, we talked a lot, but not about the future. He understood that I didn't know when or if I would be leaving again, or when or if I'd be coming home. It was rough on my parents, but then I thought of all the parents whose children were trapped on Paradise. At least my parents had been able to see me twice, even if only briefly. Going back to Dayton meant I might be able to see Rachel again. I was looking forward to that. As soon as I got into my hotel room near the Bangor airport that night, my Z-phone pinged. It was Skippy. "Hi, Joe. I couldn't talk to you while you were with your parents. There's something you need to hear. You don't like me telling you about things I overheard, but you seriously need to make an exception in this case, because it's about you." "Wait, give me a hint first, then I'll decide whether to listen." Crap. I'd been hoping for 6 hours of sleep before I had to get up. "UNEF Command has been holding what can best be described as hearings, almost a court-martial, about you." "That's not a surprise. They're not happy with me. I know that." "It's more than that, Joe. This is political. They've decided to send the Dutchman back out, duh, and there are a lot of people on Earth who want to command the mission. They're looking to stab you in the back to get you out of their way." Again, no surprise there. "What you don't know is they brought Major Smythe into Wright-Patt yesterday, and he..." "Major Smythe?" "Yes, he was officially promoted. Will you shut up so I can finish the story?" "Here, watch your Z-phone. I recorded what Smythe said. UNEF doesn't know I recorded it, so don't say anything, please." I lay on the bed, propped myself up with pillows, and watched my Z-phone. It was as interesting as Skippy promised. It was a typically bland government conference room. There was a table on an elevated platform at one end of the room. 6 generals from multiple countries and services were sitting behind the table. On the floor were other ranks of tables, and I immediately recognized Major Smythe. He looked unhappy. The quality of the video was not great. This might have been Skippy doing his surveillance through dust particles trick. One of the generals was speaking. I didn't recognize him, but from his uniform he was U.S. Air Force. "Major Smythe, quoting from your report, you described Colonel or Sergeant Bishop this way. Bishop can present himself as inexperienced, immature, inattentive to duty, and generally unsuited to command. I notice in your report you did not refer to him as Colonel." "Yes, I..." The general cut Smythe off before he could finish. "Could you explain why, despite your description of Sergeant Bishop in your report, you recommend him to command humanity's only starship again?" Smythe took a sip from his water glass to collect his thoughts. "Because, sir, if Colonel Bishop told me we were going to crash the gates of hell and the only thing we had for weapons were plastic spoons, I would follow him without hesitation. So would every other member of the Spec Ops teams from the last mission. I would follow him because I know that he would have cooked up some daft plan that any sane person would say is high and off to the right." Smythe used a U.S. military term. "Yet somehow his plan would work. Sir, I've seen Colonel Bishop dream up things that would make your head spin. But it works. It works. He comes up with ideas that even the AI hasn't thought of, things the AI didn't even realize it could do, such as how we killed that Theranin surveyor ship. Colonel Bishop had the idea for Skippy to create an especially flat area of space-time that would attract the business end of an enemy jump wormhole. It worked perfectly, sir. Perfectly. And Skippy didn't even realize he could do that until Colonel Bishop explained it to him. Also, sir. Smythe had gotten up ahead of steam and plowed ahead before he could be interrupted, leaning forward on the table for emphasis. Colonel Bishop is absolutely dedicated to duty. On that space dive he did, he offered to sacrifice himself to ensure success of the mission. Even after those two tankers jumped away and our dropship was able to recover him when his spacesuit was leaking air, he ordered the dropship to recover Skippy first.
Sergeant Bishop's admirable personal courage is not in question, nor is it relevant to this discussion. We are focused on his judgment.
The generals on the dais nodded, unconvinced.
Thank you, Major. We will take your remarks under advisement.
Permission to speak freely, sir? Smythe asked. The generals glanced at each other again.
Getting your frank and honest opinion is why we brought you here, Major.
Thank you, sir. In my report, I stated that Colonel Bishop can present himself in a particular manner. I didn't say he actually is like the negative things I described. At first, I did think Bishop was immature and almost flippant, I think is the best word, about the situation. Since then, I have come to realize that is simply his personality. I have seen Colonel Bishop be deadly serious when the situation calls for it. He coughed, took a sip of water, and continued.
In my opinion, sirs, we would be foolish not to continue with the most experienced commander we have, the only experienced commander we have.
Experienced, although he took an extreme and unwarranted risk by landing on Newark. He landed in direct contradiction to a standing mission objective.
Smythe was unfazed.
No, sir, he did not. He ordered the landing as the only certain way to support the mission objective. Colonel Bishop took action to preserve the Flying Dutchman's combat capability as long as possible. Faced with unknown future risks, he preserved our ability to take effective future action. If he had not done so...
It was Smythe's turn to look around the room.
There would be a Theranin ship on its way here now, and there would be absolutely nothing we could do about it. The mission objective was to prevent aliens from learning that humans have a starship, and that we were involved in shutting down a wormhole. We were able to accomplish that objective only because we landed on Newark. Orders issued on Earth cannot anticipate every situation we may encounter during an interstellar mission. We need a proven commander we can trust. Bishop is our only experienced commander.
My Z-phone screen went blank.
Skippy, I asked, where's the rest of it? Oh, the rest is blah, 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 more of the same. What I wanted you to see is that Major Smythe has your back. He's a good guy, in my opinion. The other Spec Ops team leaders all supported you. So did Lieutenant Colonel Chang, Major Sims, Captain Desai, Sergeant Adams, everybody.
Wow, they brought everyone there?
Huh? No, UNEF Command is holding reviews in all five UNEF countries. Only Major Smythe flew in to Wrightbat. Get some sleep, Joe. I think you are going to have a tough day tomorrow.
Right. Like I was able to sleep after that.
Paradise. To seek glory in battle is glorious emerged over Lemuria in a sudden state of gamma radiation, repeating its previous mission of burning human crops while keeping the Ruhar defenders off guard. This time, it took only 4 minutes before the Ruhar dispatched a single frigate to chase the glory away, and the two frigates tangled for another full minute before the Kristang ship jumped away. The little frigate Glory had accomplished its mission once again. The Ruhar defenders could not get any rest because of the constant threat of raids. Even more important, their ships were deferring important maintenance, which would soon begin to affect their combat readiness. The Kristang were gaining important intelligence about the tactics of the Ruhar. And the traitorous humans were being hurt. 16 humans had died during the raid, and their food supply was now dwindling, rather than increasing. Earth. What I encountered when I got to Wright-Patterson was not a court-martial. Not exactly a hearing, and not quite an inquisition either. Whatever they were calling the meeting, I was facing a row of senior officers from the five countries making up UNEF, and they didn't look friendly. The official subject of the meeting was to make preparations for the Flying Dutchman's next mission. The unspoken subject of the meeting was my competence and fitness to command a vital off-world mission, or my lack of competence and fitness in the view of UNEF command, which became clear from the tone of the questions. Of the five generals grilling me, the Chinese and British were mostly neutral, while the other three acted like I shouldn't be trusted to command a rowboat. The most hostile was U.S. Army General Ridge, who seemed to think my perceived failings as a commander reflected badly upon him personally. For almost an hour, we danced around the question of who would be in command when the Dutchman departed. Then there was a commotion in the back of the room. I tried to ignore it, until the row of senior officers in front of me halted the questioning.
"What is it, Major?" General Ridge asked.
A U.S. Air Force major in the back of the room answered.
"General, we appear to have lost all contact with the Flying Dutchman. We have tried contacting people directly. So far, no..."
"Wait, I'm getting another message." The major, whose name I didn't know, held the phone close to his ear. His face turned white.
"General, the starship has disappeared. We've lost the Dutchman."
Ridge turned to the Frenchman to his right, General Blanchard.
"Louis, this had better not be one of your tricks," Ridge said in an unfriendly tone.
The skeleton crew aboard the Dutchman was nominally under French command that week.
"I know nothing about this, Thomas," Blanchard protested. "We lost the ship. It jumped away."
"No, sir," the unnamed major reported. His shaky voice echoed the tone of panic in the room. "There was no gamma ray burst detected. It simply vanished."
"Sirs," I spoke up hesitantly.
All eyes in the room turned to me. I swallowed hard and said, "That sounds like the Dutchman engaged a stealth field. That type of field warps electromagnetic radiation, such as light, around the ship. That would make the ship appear to have disappeared."
Ridge glared at me. "Sergeant, why would the ship engage stealth in orbit? Did the ship detect a threat?"
"In case of a threat, the ship should have immediately jumped away to assess the situation. That is my standing order." I coughed nervously, suddenly all too aware that my ability to give orders to the Dutchman's crew was over. That standing order had been my reaction to watching too many dumbass commanders in science fiction movies who waited until their ship had been pounded half to dust before they tried to get away. I was not taking any stupid chances with the Dutchman. If the duty pilot thought there was something squirrely, they would jump away without asking for permission. "Sir, if I can contact Skippy, I can confirm."
"Do it, Sergeant," Ridge ordered. "You have your Z-phone?"
"Yes, sir, but I think that is not necessary. Skippy, are you there?" His voice came out of the projector system speakers.
"Ho there, Joe! Yep, I'm here in my comfy escape pod man cave as usual. Right now I'm channel surfing, enjoying a bowl of popcorn and cold brewskis. How are you doing down there?"
I had no doubt that Skippy was indeed currently surfing the content of every TV channel, radio station, and website on the planet, but he also knew exactly what was going on with me.
"Hey, Skippy. We've lost contact with the ship. Did you engage the stealth field?"
"Darn. You saw that, huh?"
"And more like we noticed there suddenly was nothing to see. What's up with that?"
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw two of the UNEF staff shaking their heads at my unprofessional, casual language. Screw them. They didn't know Skippy like I did. They hadn't worked with Skippy to save the world. Save the freaking world twice.
"I'm not feeling the love, Joe. So I metaphorically have pulled up the rope ladder to my treehouse fort, and I'm not allowing anyone up here unless they know the secret handshake. Oh, I don't have hands. Maybe it should be the secret password. Yeah, that's it."
"Mr. Skippy," General Ridge said, automatically looking at the speaker like I did, although it made no difference. "You are threatening to lock us out of our ship?"
"General Fudge." Skippy made me wince when he said that. "Two things. First, it is not your ship. You haven't spilled any blood or risked your life up here or survived for weeks on crappy Theranin sludges. So until you wear the Paramecium with eye patch badge on your uniform, you will never again refer to the Flying Dutchman as your anything." He didn't wait for an answer. "Second, a threat is a statement of intention to perform a hostile act in the future. I have already done it, so the threat phase of this incident is over."
My eyes opened about as wide as they could go as General Ridge shot me an angry glare.
Skippy, General Ridge is..."
"Yeah, yeah, he's served with honor, blah, blah, blah. None of that means squat to me, Joe. Where was he when I was stuck on a dusty warehouse shelf?"
Where was he when we captured two warships? I don't remember him space diving with me and offering to risk burning up in a planet's atmosphere so I could complete the mission. Enough with words. Only the cool kids can come aboard the Dutchman. Fudgy is not one of the cool kids.
Ridge didn't get to be a general officer by being intimidated by words of any kind.
What I have been told is that you, Mr. Skippy, can't maneuver any ship you are aboard. We have the capability to reach Earth orbit on our own, and our people up there should be capable of disabling the stealth field eventually. We can regain control of that ship.
Sure. You flying monkeys can come up here. If I were you, I would be very careful to make damn sure this ship's defensive weapons are not on automatic. It would be terrible if one of your crappy space capsules got shredded by a maser cannon.
Skippy, I said through clenched teeth, that is not funny.
I wasn't joking, Joe. The crew up here could try to deactivate those weapons, but since you can't communicate with them, there's no way to be sure they were successful before you launch from orbit. And I know the crew here will do their best, but darn, these Theranan controls are complicated. Best not to let monkeys screw with the controls. I locked them out to be safe. There, that's done.
General Ridge looked like he was about to bust a blood vessel. I spoke quickly before he could say anything that Skippy might object to.
General, I warned. Too often we think of Skippy as a lovably mischievous beer can. He is not. He is an ancient artificial intelligence who was created by a species that built the wormhole network. Sir, I have seen Skippy rip a hole in a star. He is not joking when he says that he will defend himself. We cannot screw with him.
Well said, Colonel Joe, Skippy chuckled.
Now, General Fudge, you consider yourself to be a plain-spoken man, so let's cut through the bullshit right now. You need the Flying Dutchman to go back out in order to verify there isn't another Theranan ship on its way to Earth. The Dutchman can't fly without me, and I'm not helping the merry band of pirates fly the ship unless I'm happy. So here is my very simple condition. Joe Bishop is captain of the ship. He is astonishingly stupid most of the time, but he has flashes of competence. Oh, one more condition, I guess. The French team brought a horribly stinky cheese up here with them last time. Ugh, I still got maintenance bots scrubbing the air filters near the galley. So, no more stinky cheeses. That's it, I think. Now, Fudgy, you can continue talking if you want, but you're wasting everyone's time. And in this case, time is not money, it is lives. The lives of every human on Earth, who are at risk every day the Dutchman is not out there safeguarding your miserable planet.
Damn, I thought. That was a good speech.
Of course I didn't say that. What I said was, Skippy, we all heard you loud and clear. You've made your point. And could you please take the Dutchman out of stealth, restore communications, and take the defensive weapons offline?
For you, Joe?
Certainly.
Done.
In the end, Skippy got everything he asked for. Unfortunately, despite all of his amazing intelligence, he neglected to ask for the right freaking thing. UNEF grudgingly confirmed me as the captain of the Flying Dutchman and restored my theater rank of colonel again. That is what Skippy demanded. I was not, however, going to be commander of the mission. UNEF insisted on assigning me a senior UN official from a neutral nation as overall commander. He was Austrian, and his name was Hans Chotek. Naturally, that is not what Skippy called him.
Oh, man, I screwed up big time, Skippy lamented.
I'm sorry, Joe. What's this guy look like? I had a briefing packet on Hans Chotek, but I hadn't read it yet.
Well, Joe, he looks like a movie star.
Skippy's praise surprised me.
That was a nice thing to say, Skip.
If the movie star had gotten run over by the ugly truck and died several years ago...
Whew!
Are we really going to be stuck with Count Chocula for the whole mission?
Count Chocula? That made me laugh. How did you get that name?
Count, because his family traces back to royalty in Austria, and Chotek sounds kind of like chocolate. Also, one of his ancestors made his fortune in chocolate, so...
Oh, man. You didn't tell him that you named him after an American children's breakfast cereal, did you?
First time I talked with him, yes, of course I did. Come on, Joe. You know me. No way could I pass up a golden opportunity like that. He had no idea what I meant at first, so I changed his official UN photo online to the Count. I'm sure he will get a good laugh at it someday. He hasn't been laughing so far.
That means he did not find it amusing.
Skippy, do you really think it is best to antagonize the guy right from the start? If we get off on the wrong foot,
Joe. I want to get off on the wrong foot with this pompous jerk. I want him to know crystal clear right off the bat that I do not want him on our ship at all, Skippy said, mixing metaphors liberally. Our ship? Me, you, the merry band of pirates? I'll include Dr. Friedlander, too, because he tells good jokes and it's fun to mess with him. Not that you would do something like that to our rocket scientist. Not as far as Friedlander knows, Joe. Great. So we have a captain and a commander, and we'll get a crew. There is one thing that I need from you, Skippy. What is that? He asked warily. I promise that this time, we will be bringing the Dutchman back to Earth before you go do your beaming up to the collective thing. Oh, that's easy. The answer is yes. Yes, we will. Joe, we can keep looking for comm nodes, because I need to know whether the two we have found are defective, or, I hate to say this, or the comm nodes work fine, but there is no longer a network for them to connect with. But I do not want to contact the Collective until we have answers for the strange and disturbing things that have been going on in this galaxy. Because you're afraid of looking ignorant in front of the Collective, I guessed. Because I'm afraid of what I don't know, Joe. More importantly, because I'm afraid that a lot of what I think I know doesn't match facts we have recently discovered. I can't trust my own data, and that scares me. Paradise. General Nivelle, the current commander of UNEF on Paradise, addressed Deputy Administrator Logelia in her office. We are prisoners of war, and you are our captors. You have a responsibility to protect us from harm during our captivity, Nivelle declared. The leadership post had recently rotated to the French after the Chinese, and Nivelle almost wished the rotation had skipped over him. It was a thankless and largely powerless position, from which the soldiers of UNEF expected him to produce miracles on a daily basis. The raids on human cropland by the Kristang were becoming a serious problem. Not only were humans dying directly by being caught in the path of a maser beam, but the expected crop yield had now been reduced by 7%. The next harvest was now anticipated to be just above the level required to supply humans with daily calories. There was no longer a safety margin for crop failures. Rain and hailstorms wiping out fields, transport disruptions, or anything else that surely would happen along the way. Most troubling was that the Kristang raids seemed to be growing worse, and the Ruhar were not doing anything about the raids. During the last two raids, the Kristang ship had been free to target human croplands for several minutes without the Ruhar taking any action. Humans were dying by maser fire, and soon would be dying of malnutrition and starvation. Legally, no, we do not, responded the Burgermeister carefully. The combatants in this war do not have the equivalent of your Geneva Convention, she pronounced slowly so the translator software could catch up. Nivelle had expected that response and was prepared for it. He noted that Ms. Logelia had pronounced Geneva precisely, which told him she had practiced for this conversation. Good. Better for him to have this discussion with an alien who was at least informed about Earth customs. I have studied the history of this seemingly endless conflict you are engaged in. You are correct that there is no formal signed treaty between your government and that of the Kristang. There is, however, an unspoken agreement that has been adhered to by both sides for hundreds of years. You treat Kristang prisoners as you would wish the Kristang would treat your people if they were captured, and the Kristang generally have done the same. Prisoners are provided food, shelter, medical care, regular opportunities to exercise, and are allowed limited communication with their families. You also regularly negotiate prisoner exchanges. There is in effect a de facto Geneva Convention agreement, whether it has been formally signed or not. We humans have not been provided food and shelter. We grow our own food and build our own shelters. Medical care is limited to what we can do with the extremely limited supplies we have left. And we have had no communication with Earth since you took this planet back. Nivelle glanced out the window behind the Burgermeister where a gunship fighter aircraft that humans called a chicken was taking off. A real window, in a real office, in a real building. Nivelle's ad hoc UNEF HQ office in Lemuria was a partition in a tent, and he slept in a tent. The Ruhar had offered equipment, supplies, and even a few workers to help construct a building. Nivelle and the UNEF commanders before him insisted the effort would be better directed to more important facilities for humans, such as hospitals, air raid shelters, barracks for housing, barns for livestock, and storing harvested food. Luxuries like offices could wait. One thing Nivelle had noticed as soon as he was invited into the Burgermeister's office was the smell, or lack of it. His own tent had a pervasive, musty scent of dampness and mildew, despite the high-tech anti-mold chemicals provided by the Ruhar. The problem with the cluster of tents that served as UNEF's temporary headquarters was that in the jungles of Lemuria, it rained every single afternoon. Sometimes it rained more than once a day. Humans were not the only creatures struggling to adapt to the jungle. Many earth crops did not grow optimally in the hot, humid conditions. Ruhar scientists were working, when they had time and resources, to tweak the Earth's plants' genetics to grow better and yield more in the jungle. Nothing had been promised to UNEF about using the supremely advanced biological knowledge of the Ruhar other than that they were doing what they could. Doing what they could for free, for an enemy that had tried to eject them from their home planet. The southern portion of Lemuria was generally drier grasslands and would likely be better suited to human habitation and earth crops. Moving farther to the south was not an option, the Ruhar had declared. It was too far away from the support facilities of the northern continent. And because of high mountains that cut across Lemuria east to west at the southern end of the jungle, there were no roads to the southern grasslands. Humans needed to deal with the situation as best they could. They didn't have a choice.
"The situation," the Burgermeister said quietly, "is complicated by the fact that you are being attacked by your own side, General Nivelle. When you came here to occupy our planet, the Kristang were your patrons, and you were their client species. You were acting at the orders of the Kristang, and with the support of the Kristang to remove my people from their home, this planet. That arrangement, that relationship between humans and Kristang, has not, to my knowledge, changed. Even under a de facto Geneva Convention, as you said." The translator stumbled over "de facto," but Nivelle understood. "We are not responsible for internal enemy affairs. Likewise, you do understand that if we did negotiate a prisoner exchange, we would not be responsible for the fate of you humans once you are back under Kristang control."
"We have not asked to be exchanged," Nivelle said stiffly.
"I would not recommend it," the Burgermeister said with grave seriousness. "We have monitored the transmissions the Kristang directed at you. They consider you to be traitors. The Kristang deal harshly with those who they feel have betrayed them, even among their own kind. With species they consider to be inferior?" She shook her head. "If you were turned over to them, they might execute all of you. Certainly they would execute you personally, and the top echelon of your command, and probably any female humans in a position of authority. You know now the Kristang philosophy on proper gender roles," the female deputy administrator of the planet said with a grimace. "So when a Kristang ship raids this planet and kills humans, we must view the incident at least partially as a matter internal to the Kristang coalition."
"We have no option then," Nivelle said bitterly. "We can't switch sides and join the Ruhar. Our governments back on Earth have declared loyalty to the Kristang."
"That is not true," the Burgermeister announced, shocking Nivelle. "There are many cases where one group of a species splits from its parent and switches sides."
"I am surprised to hear this," Nivelle stuttered. "How is this possible?"
"It happens over the course of a very long war," the Burgermeister said with a human-like shrug. "For example, there is a group of Kristang who live on a planet that my people captured around 400 of your years ago. These Kristang decided to stay and repudiate their allegiance to the two clans they belong to."
"This can't be a common occurrence," General Nivelle asked warily.
"It was a special circumstance," she admitted. "The Kristang on that planet had been isolated from the rest of their kind for many years. The planet was at the extreme end of the territory the Theranin controlled. Then the Giraptha cut off the Theranin's access to a wormhole, and the planet became isolated. We ignored the planet for over 2 centuries, merely monitoring it to assure the Kristang there did not pose a threat to us.
By the time we besieged the planet, the Kristang there had drifted far from the cultural norm of their species. They declared that the Kristang had lost their souls to the Theranin, that their true culture had been perverted by their patrons. These Kristang, who now called themselves the True Ones, are not entirely consumed by warfare, and they requested our assistance to return their females to their original genetic baseline. These True Ones could be considered neutrals, or as close to neutral as any sentient being is allowed to be in this galaxy, she observed sadly. Their industry provides material support to our war effort, and they have been provided warriors to fight alongside Ruhar. The warriors of the True Ones are known for being absolutely fanatical in battle. They know that if any of them are captured by the Kristang, they will be tortured and killed.
I am asking a hypothetical question. You understand what a hypothetical question is?
Nevel was not entirely confident in the translator. Eventually, he needed to learn more than a few words of Ruhar. The Burgermeister nodded silently, so the UNEF commander continued.
If we humans here on Paradise were to offer allegiance with the Ruhar, would it be accepted? And what would that mean for my people, here and on Earth?
Materna Logelia paused to collect her thoughts. She could not tell the human commander that her own government was negotiating to trade away the planet, in the process screwing both the native Ruhar and the humans.
The decision to accept your allegiance would be far above my head. I could make a discreet inquiry. However, it would take several months at the very least. My confidence in our communications security is not sufficient for me to trust sending such a message via electronic means, no matter the level of encryption. Such a delicate matter would require me sending a courier to our home world.
Seeing Nevel's crestfallen look, she hastened to add,
We have couriers traveling regularly. The next is scheduled to depart within 2 weeks.
A discreet inquiry would be greatly appreciated, Madame Logelia. This is, of course, all hypothetical.
Of course, she smiled. General, you should not discuss this with anyone, unless you are standing in a field, far from any electronic equipment. I do not think I am giving away any secret when I say that your own communications are entirely compromised, since your Z-phones, she used the human slang term, use our satellite network. If the Kristang are able to intercept our satellite communications...
Understood, Nevel said helplessly.
There was no point in attempting to establish a separate human communications network. The Ruhar could easily breach even the best human encryption. Nevel suspected the Ruhar had the capability to implant nanoscale spies directly into the hardware, so they wouldn't even need to bother with decrypting signals. There was no point to complaining about something he could do nothing about. Earth. It was great to have settled the question of whether I would be in command of the next mission, or even going at all. It was not great that UNEF Command wanted the ship to depart Earth orbit within 17 days, and we had a tremendous amount of work to do before then. Major Sims, who had volunteered to go back out, needed to replenish our supplies. Skippy had to oversee manufacture of some key ship components that he hadn't been able to make from moon dust on our last mission. He was given a blank check to use whatever manufacturing capability he needed on Earth. That was less useful than I expected, because Skippy told me human materials technology was so primitive, it was in many cases easier for him to create needed things from raw materials. Major Sims was in charge of coordinating with UNEF Command all the items we would need for the next mission, and the large list of equipment Skippy said he needed to continue repairing and upgrading the Dutchman. Sims and I went over the list at Wrightpat, and some of the things Skippy wanted puzzled us both. Skippy, I asked, this is a big list. I can see how most of it would be useful, I guess, but why do you need 6 crates of WD-40?
WD-40?
Oh, that was just me messing with you. You monkeys didn't know that was a joke? Damn, your species is clueless sometimes. Sims looked like she would have tossed him out an airlock right then if we'd been aboard the Dutchman. I wasn't happy with him either. That was not funny, Skippy. We've got people working 24/7 down there to...
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. I get it, Joe. Won't happen again.
Man, you hate it any time I have fun. Listen, to be serious, there is only so much I can do to keep the ship running without access to a Theranin space dock. Star carriers are designed to operate on their own for extended missions, but we've been out on our own for too long, and the ship got beat up pretty badly on our last mission. Eventually, we will need access to Theranin spare parts, or we're going to need another ship.
Crap. I looked at Sims, and we both frowned.
Not on this mission, right? That depends on how long the next mission lasts and what kind of stress we put the ship through, Joe. I can't make promises without knowing the parameters. On the last mission, we didn't expect to get ambushed by a Theranin destroyer squadron.
He had a point. I didn't like it. Until then, the thought that the Flying Dutchman would wear out, could wear out, hadn't occurred to me. The technology of the ship seemed more like magic than anything created by living beings. Skippy did a great job behind the scenes, using robots to perform maintenance, and even daily chores like cleaning and doing our laundry. Whatever Skippy did to keep the ship operating was invisible to me. It was time I started paying careful attention to how much effort went into keeping the ship's magical machines working. The other thing that was not great was that UNEF Command put me on a plane flying to Paris that very afternoon. Paris, France, not the one in Texas. I went into a bathroom on the plane for privacy and called Rachel on my Z-phone.
Hi, Joe. She sounded happy. How is Maine? I checked the weather report this morning. It looks nice up there.
I'm on a plane to Paris, I blurted out.
Paris? I've always wanted to go there. This for work?
There was a tone to a voice that I interpreted as asking whether I was going to Paris with a girlfriend. Yes, UNEF sent me. This is a last-minute thing.
Are you coming back to Dayton?
I don't know. Rachel, I truly don't know. The ship is going back out soon, and I didn't know what else to say.
I see.
Her voice changed, and I couldn't tell whether she was hurt or angry or relieved.
You don't know when you're coming back?
No. Damn it. I had always sucked at talking over a phone. Rachel, we don't even know where we're going. I took a deep breath.
Listen, Rachel. When I get back, Joe, she interrupted me. Were you about to make a promise that you don't know if you can keep? Don't do that.
I what? I'm an idiot?
You're lonely, Joe. I could tell that right away. You were away from home for a long time, and now you're going back out. We had fun. I'm glad I met you. It's not like you left in the middle of the night. You have a mission, and you have to go. I understand. I was in the Air Force, remember?
We awkwardly chatted for another few minutes, ending with me saying that if I could get back to Wright-Patt before going into orbit, I would contact her. She told me that wouldn't be a good idea. I could see her point. When you tear off a Band-Aid, you don't want to put it back on and do it again. Best to get it over with once. My history with women seems to be they had me on a catch-and-release program. If my past was any indicator, Rachel had her fill of Joe Bishop and was ready to move on. Crap, my longest current relationship was with a shiny beer can.
Maybe I needed to seriously rethink my life.
Chapter 5. Paradise. With almost simultaneous gamma ray bursts, the Kristang frigate, To Seek Glory and Battle Is Glorious, and the destroyer We Are Proud to Honor Clan Subleader Rosh Atal Vergent, who inspires us every day, emerged above Lemuria about 23,000 kilometers apart. They emerged on either side of the unlucky Ruhar frigate Tolin Grathur. Because of pressure put on the Task Force Commodore by the Chief Administrator, the defending Task Force had stationed a single frigate above Lemuria to prevent, or at least lessen, the severity of future raids. Unfortunately for the Grathur, the Kristang had been watching that ship's patrols and noticed a pattern. There was a place the Ruhar frigate returned to reliably every 11 hours. Seeing an opportunity to hit the enemy hard with manageable risk, the Kristang Task Force commander had approved the idea of a raid by the captain of the destroyer Vergent, and naturally the experienced frigate Glory had been assigned to the mission. That fact understandably did not please the crew of the Little Glory. Both Kristang ships emerged with weapons hot and fired missiles, maser cannons, and the destroyer launched railgun darts at the Grathur.
Only luck saved the Grether from complete destruction that day. A maser beam from the Glory hit a missile from the Vergent just as that missile evaded the Grether's point defenses. Instead of a devastating direct hit, the explosion of the missile warhead 1,200 kilometers away only severely damaged the Grether, allowing that hapless ship to perform a short emergency jump. The Grether would be out of service for several weeks repairing damage, which the Kristang commander counted as good as a kill. The captain of the Vergent was bitterly disappointed that he could not claim a complete victory that day, and he had blamed the crew of the Glory, although it had been an accident. The Vergent's missile had been maneuvering violently to avoid fire from the Grether's point defense cannons and flew right into a maser beam from the Glory. In the chaos of battle, it happened, and it was no one's fault. The crew of the Vergent still blamed the Glory. The crew of the Glory were happy merely to have survived another day. Earth. The next call I needed to make was to one of the prior Merry Band of Pirates. Hey, Skippy, I have a special request. It's kind of unusual. I need to call someone, and I need the call to be completely private on both ends. Sure thing. Is this person living or dead? What? Living, of course. Wait. Skippy could do so many incredible things, and he was still constantly surprising me with things he could do. Oh, my God. Can you really talk to dead people? No, you big stupid head, he laughed. Of course not. Damn, you are dense sometimes. Then why the hell did you ask? You said this request is unusual, so I was trying to judge just how idiotic this was going to be. You know, will this be normal Joe-level moronic, or are you cooking up something truly special to entertain me? You are such an asshole. Can you do it or not? Whew! He let out an exasperated breath. Please. Easy peasy, Joe. Who do you want to call? Dr. Friedlander. Our friendly local rocket scientist? Is he in any condition to talk? I think he sprained his brain aboard the Dutchman trying to understand how the reactors work, Skippy chuckled. Skippy, be nice once in a while. Okay, okay. For a monkey, he's not nearly as dim as the rest of you. And he does tell good jokes sometimes. Friedlander. Tells jokes? This completely surprised me, although I hadn't spent much time with the science team. Yes. Aboard the ship, he started every science team meeting with a joke. Like, did you hear the one about the rooster? Skippy was going to tell the joke anyway, so I played along. No. This farmer has a rooster that is growing old, and the farmer decides it's time to get a new rooster. So he goes down the road to his neighbor, Gilroy, and he buys a young rooster. When he gets home, Skippy was already laughing at his own joke, he puts the young rooster in the pen. The young rooster struts up to the old rooster and says, "Hey, old-timer, you need to hit the road. This is my place now." The old rooster says, "You're right, it is my time, but I'll tell you what. Someday you'll be old, and a young rooster will come along to kick you out. I don't want the ladies to see me just walk away. Could you chase me around some? We'll fight for a minute for me to keep my dignity, and then I'll leave." And the young rooster feels sorry for the old one and says, "Sure, old-timer, let's go." So the young rooster chases the old rooster around the hen house, and the farmer comes out to see what the commotion is. He says, "What the hell?" He grabs his shotgun and blows the young rooster away. As the old rooster is chuckling, the farmer says, "Damn, Gilroy done sold me a gay rooster." I laughed, and Skippy laughed. You're right, that is a good one. Maybe I needed to make more of an effort to get to know all the people aboard the ship. Can you call Friedlander? Wait a minute. He's in his kitchen with his wife right now. I can make the call completely private, but I can't prevent his wife from overhearing him talk. He is about to go outside to get something out of the tool shed. You can talk to him then. I was curious. How do you know he's in the kitchen? Duh. You really have to ask? Seriously? Well, since you asked, in this particular case, they have one of those fancy refrigerators with internet connectivity and touch screen. That is not the best idea if you're concerned about privacy, by the way. Also, one of their yogurts is expired. It's behind the bread. That's why they haven't noticed it. I made a mental note to get a really, really old non-digital fridge if I ever got a place of my own. Okay, Friedlander just walked outside. I'll call his phone now? Yes, thank you. There was a delay of a couple seconds, and I was about to ask Skippy what was the problem. Then I heard Friedlander's voice. Hello? Who is this? He demanded. Doctor, it's Joe Bishop.
Oh, sorry for snapping at you. There was no caller ID, and I don't usually answer those calls, but my phone somehow picked up the call by itself.
That's because this call is going through Skippy, not a cellular network.
Yes, Skippy's voice broke in. Skippytel has amazing rate plans and the best quality of service. Exclusions apply, not available in other solar systems or to people I don't like.
Got it, Skippy. Thank you, I said. I'll consider switching my plan to Skippytel. Please send me your brochure. Dr. Friedlander, we're going through Skippy because I want this call to be completely private. Can you talk?
Give me a moment. Okay, I'm in my tool shed, and my wife is in the house.
UNEF has decided to send the Dutchman back out.
I would have thought that was obvious, he said. I could hear the sarcasm in his voice.
And so did I, but it took a while for the bureaucratic wheels to get into motion, I guess. The reason I called is to see if you were interested in going back out with us.
Oh, wait a minute. He was silent a moment. I had to check that my wife is still in the house. I am not sure about going again, Colonel Bishop, he answered slowly. Last week, NASA invited me to train for the mission to recover that Kristang troopship. We still have to do that? Skippy won't bring that troopship back for us? I asked him to bring it back for my birthday. Now my voice had the sarcasm.
Joe! Skippy broke in again. I already got you a pair of socks.
And I appreciate that, Skippy. Truthfully, I would rather have a starship.
These are a very nice pair of socks, Joe, he said with a sniff.
However, I will consider it.
Unless Skippy changes his mind soon, I concluded. We should assume NASA has to go out there in old-fashioned chemical rockets. You would rather go on that mission than join us aboard the Dutchman again?
What I want is not the only consideration.
Oh, crap, this was going to get complicated.
My wife told me she married an engineer, not an astronaut. She was a nervous wreck when we got home.
Doctor, this time we do expect the Dutchman to return. Last time we didn't. But you went anyway.
I didn't quite believe your speech about how we wouldn't be coming back.
I wasn't kidding about that, I said, frustrated. Which I realized when we got out there, and I learned that we can't operate the ship without Skippy. By then it was too late. Before we left, I told my wife there was no way UNEF would allow a valuable asset like a Theranan starship to be put at risk. I figured all the talk about the high level of risk was something UNEF lawyers made you say. So that if anything did go wrong, the families couldn't sue UNEF.
Sorry about that.
Colonel, I wasn't the only person who thought that way. The whole science team did.
All my serious speeches had been for nothing?
I suppose it doesn't matter now.
Your wife is okay with you going into space with NASA?
No. No, I told NASA that I need to think about it. My wife is very much against me going up in a NASA rocket, or a Chinese rocket. Any craft we send out to that troop ship will be experimental. I'm not enthusiastic about the idea either. NASA wants me to go because they're hoping that I learned enough about the flower to be able to get the troop ship's reactor restarted.
That surprised me.
You can do that?
No.
And I told that to NASA. I think they're hoping that I'm wrong.
Colonel, I appreciate the offer. I gathered so much data aboard the flower and the Dutchman already, it will take me years to...
I need you to lead the new science team, I said before he could finish.
Me?
Colonel, I'm an engineer. I don't do basic research and theory. I figure out how to make theories do something useful. Out among the stars, we should be...
Doctor, on this mission, UNEF wants engineers, not biologists or cosmologists.
I stumbled over that word.
Wasn't that people who gave fancy haircuts?
No, I remembered with relief. Those were cosmetologists, like my cousin Debbie.
Or chemists, or any kind of ist.
UNEF wants people who can figure out how the Dutchman and any other alien technology we encounter works.
Friedlander sounded puzzled.
Why didn't they do that the first time?
Because, as I said many times, last time they didn't really expect the ship to ever come back.
And this time they do, so they care about us delivering concrete results.
You got it, Doctor.
There was a pause in the conversation. Maybe I should have done this face-to-face rather than over a phone. I pictured him in a tool shed surrounded by a lawnmower, weed whacker, rakes, shovels, and a bucket of topsoil. If I closed my eyes, I knew what it smelled like. A bit musty with dried dirt and grass and gasoline and plywood. It smelled like suburbia.
It smelled like freedom. It smelled like America. Finally, he spoke.
Why me, Colonel?
You have experience aboard the Dutchman, and that counts a lot, because it means you have proven to be cool under pressure. Also, you got along well with people in a confined environment. That counted for a lot. There had been flare-ups of personality conflicts even among our carefully chosen merry band of pirates. Mostly I'm hoping you are someone I can count on. We are sticking to a limit of 70 people again, and this time we will have some, let's say, observers and intel people from UNEF. So the science team will have fewer people. I'd like you to select a wide mix of expertise for your team. Doctor, you know that we have no idea what fields of knowledge we will need once we're out there. On Newark, biology and archaeology were critical for unraveling the mystery of that planet. And the science team ran an analysis that made Skippy realize an entire moon had been vaporized. UNEF is going to want to stuff the science team with you rocket scientist types so they can hopefully figure out how Theranan technology works. You understand how useful it might be for that team to not be narrowly focused. It may mean the difference between us coming home or not.
I agree with you on that point, Colonel.
Do you need an answer right now?
No, I replied. Give it 3 days. No more than that, though. If you're on board, you'll need to head start selecting your team.
Oh, he groaned. This is not going to be easy to sell to my wife. And there, I knew he wanted to come with us.
I understand. Doctor, I'm not going to give you a duty, honor, a humanity speech. I'd very much appreciate if you can come with us, but you've done your duty already. Think about it, and call me either way, please.
Friedlander called me the next morning, waking me from sleep because I was on Paris time.
Colonel Bishop, you still want me on the next mission?
Absolutely. We need you to lead the science team, and Skippy wants you aboard because he says you tell good jokes.
I didn't know that.
Friedlander chuckled.
Why did the two blondes freeze to death at the drive-in theater?
I don't know.
They went to see Closed for the Winter.
Ah, I laughed. That is a good one.
Skippy is right.
Someone needed to lighten up our boring science team meetings.
Colonel, I discussed the situation with my wife last night, and I will join the mission on two conditions.
Okay, what are those?
Please, please, I said to myself, make it something reasonable.
First, this time we are coming back, correct? That is the plan?
I'm the wrong person to answer that question, but yes.
Skippy has promised me we will bring the ship back to Earth before the next mission, whatever that is.
He wants to hold off contacting the Collective until he has answers about what happened to Newark and some other things.
Friedlander gave an audible sigh of relief.
That is good to hear. My wife will be very pleased to hear that. And I've told her that being aboard the Dutchman is safer than going up in that spacecraft NASA is building.
Don't tell NASA I said that.
I won't.
And your second condition?
Promise me that I won't be killed on some planet by a giant space lizard.
That made me laugh.
Doctor, don't worry. If you are ever about to be eaten by a giant space lizard, I will shoot you first.
That's close enough, I guess.
Colonel, would you like to see the list of people I want on the science team?
It will be your science team, Doctor. The team is your choice. The 7 best qualified people you can find.
Whew, he exhaled.
That's a lot of pressure on me, then.
7 qualified people who are willing to leave on short notice for an interstellar mission of unknown danger.
Can I promise they won't be eaten by a giant space lizard?
Let's not go crazy, Doctor. We may need to throw one of them to the giant space lizard to save ourselves.
In Paris, I met the new mission commander, Hans Chotek. We had a cordial and professional meeting that I almost ruined by calling him Chocula. Luckily, I caught myself in time and said Chotek instead. Skippy had shown me the mission commander's resume, and it was impressive, particularly for a guy in his early 40s. He had been all over the world and handled all kinds of crises for the UN. Not all of them successfully, of course, because it is, you know, the UN. We got off on the wrong foot by him spending the first 20 minutes trying to impress me. Then he must have realized I was bored. My jaw-stretching yawn may have been a clue. So we talked about the mission objectives UNEF Command had given us. Given to him.
Sir, I began, I do have a problem with our mission objectives. One of them.
He looked mildly surprised. Whether he was surprised that I disagreed with the mission objectives established by UNEF Command, or surprised that a comparatively low-ranking sergeant colonel would express doubts openly, I couldn't guess.
Our primary objective...
I shook my head. Our primary objective is correct, and I have no problem with it. We were tasked primarily with determining what the Thorana knew about the destruction of their surveyor task force, and whether they would be sending another ship to Earth. The primary objective also stated that if we found a way to establish an ongoing intelligence source to proactively warn us about threats to Earth, we should take the opportunity to do so. Fine. All that made sense to me. The only quibble I had about our primary objective was that UNEF Command had been frustratingly vague about what we were supposed to do if we learned another surveyor ship was on its way to Earth. If the Thoranan planned to send a surveyor ship, but that ship was not scheduled to begin its mission until well in the future, we were to take the Dutchman all the way back to Earth for consultation? If there was not enough time to consult with Earth, we were to use our best judgment, meaning Chotek's judgment, since UNEF Command had been clear that they did not trust mine. Were we supposed to prevent a second surveyor from reaching Earth, even if the risk of exposing the fact that humans were flying around in our own pirate starship? If so, what level of exposure risk was acceptable? UNEF Command had provided no guidance on that critical issue. Those damned cowards who had reamed me a new asshole over the carefully measured and entirely successful risk I took in landing on Newark were afraid to make any judgment of their own. Anyway, the first objective we were given was fine. We could manage any ambiguities when we had to. The decision would not be up to me. It would be Chotek who would make the final call. Except that I, Skippy, the Merry Band of Pirates, and even Count Chocula himself fully expected me to mutiny and override Chotek's decision if I thought it endangered humanity. Great. Whatever. Such is the life of a pirate captain. What I would appreciate is some nice pirate booty to go with the responsibility, but that wasn't going to happen. The problem is our secondary objective, I explained. To gather information about the expeditionary force on Paradise? Now he was clearly surprised.
I do not understand, Mr. Bishop. Surely you of all people would want to know the fate of your fellow soldiers in UNEF.
I would like to know, if the answer is they are all living happily ever after on Paradise, I said with what I hoped came across as sarcasm. The problem is that I think it extremely unlikely that fairy tale is the truth. It is much more likely that we are going to discover information that is not so favorable, that UNEF on Paradise is struggling, or in danger, or being persecuted. And then what? What good does it do for us to have that unpleasant information?
When we have information, we have choices, Mr. Bishop. Without information,
choices to do what exactly, Mr. Chotek? I see one choice if we discover the expeditionary force on Paradise is endangered. We feel bad about it, and we do absolutely nothing. That is the same effective result as if we discover they are all living happy lives of luxury. In either case, we do absolutely nothing. We can't do anything useful. We can't do anything at all. We can't even send them a message, because that would undoubtedly be intercepted by the Ruhar or Krestang or both. Then the whole galaxy would know that humans escaped from Paradise and are flying around in a pirate ship.
Surely we can... Looking for trouble on Paradise goes against two principles I have learned in my career, Mr. Chotek.
First, never ask a question for which you don't want to hear the answer. Second, never give an order you know won't be obeyed.
What does that mean, Colonel?
He asked evenly, but I could see his Adam's apple bob ever so slightly with anxiety. Mr. Chotek, we have a crew of highly dedicated, highly trained, highly motivated special forces who have what we in the military call a bias for action. When they see a problem, they want to act. They expect to act. What do you think will happen when they learn our people on Paradise are threatened or are actively being killed?
I expect they are also highly disciplined, Colonel Bishop.
What would you do?
That would certainly depend on the situation.
And, great. Then let me present you with an example. I took a breath and plunged ahead. Let's say we are in the Paradise system, under stealth, or however we get close enough to obtain intel. We learn, we see, that our people are in prison camps being starved because they have run out of food, and the Ruhar have a very limited ability to feed them. Half of the expeditionary force has already died of starvation. The Ruhar military force on and around Paradise is weak, weak enough that this ship could take them on easily. We could take the planet back. We could feed some of our people. We could even bring some of them home. What will you order us to do?
You are the mission commander. This is your decision.
He took a moment to answer.
I see your point, Colonel. Any action we take would expose us and endanger Earth. As difficult as it would be, my decision would have to be that the ship must remain in stealth and return to Earth without intervening or revealing our presence.
You expect that order to be obeyed? Do you really expect the crew of this pirate ship to stand down and do nothing while our people, their comrades, are dying?
This time he did not answer immediately.
Would you obey such an order, Colonel?
I don't know, I answered honestly. And if I pass that order on to my subordinates, I am not confident my orders would be obeyed.
I see, Chotek said thoughtfully.
We are all alone out there, Mr. Chotek. During our last mission, I was outside the ship in a spacesuit with a spec ops team for zero gravity training. One of the special forces asked Skippy whether we could see the sun from there, and Skippy enhanced the image in our helmet visors so we could see the faint light of our home star. I remember Skippy reminding us that the light we were seeing then left the sun 1,800 years ago. The Roman Empire ruled the Mediterranean back then. Under that perspective, the authority of Earth begins to seem thin after we pass through a couple wormholes.
Colonel, he said, you have given me much to think about. Please understand that I have limited flexibility about our mission objectives. UNEF Command made it very clear that they want to know the situation on Paradise. Unless there is a compelling reason for us not to pursue gathering information about Paradise, I do not see that I have authority to override that objective, regardless of my personal feelings on the subject.
A compelling reason, I mused. How about this? If you judge that pursuing intelligence about Paradise posed a risk of this ship exposing our presence out here, would that be a compelling reason to override our stated objective, even if such exposure were, let's say, inadvertent?
He pinched his chin. This was deeply troubling him. His entire purpose for being aboard the Flying Dutchman was because UNEF did not trust my judgment about keeping our pirate ship secret. Now he saw that assuring we took zero risk of exposure was a complicated calculation. Virtually anything we did on the other side of Earth's local wormhole risked exposure.
I will need to think about this, he said. We have to achieve our primary objective first. Then we will need to reevaluate our next steps.
And Colonel, I do appreciate that our primary objective involves considerable risk of us becoming exposed. None of these decisions will be simple or easy.
I was glad to hear that, even if it was a little late. Flying all the way to Paris, except for the meeting of our new mission commander, was a waste of my time. After 3 days of me trying to run the ship from the ground, Skippy sent down a dropship and I went aboard the Flying Dutchman. The ship was a beehive of frantic activity, even more than last time. The difference this time was UNEF Command expected us to come back, so they cared that we had everything we might need loaded aboard. When Major Sims first saw me, she snapped a quick salute, threw up her hands, and shooed me out of the cargo bay so she could get a mountain of gear stowed away.
Sir, a haggard-looking Major Sims said as she knocked on my office door frame a couple minutes later.
We have two more shipments coming up from Earth, then we'll be fully loaded. I was able to get all the special items you asked for except for this fluff thing. She looked at me with a raised eyebrow. I was able to get a different kind of marshmallow cream.
She held up a white plastic jar from a warehouse store. It was labeled marshmallow cream.
I sucked in a breath.
Generic? Fluff? I sputtered in shock. Until that moment, I hadn't known there was anything but true fluff. The white jar in her hand emanated pure evil. I could barely look at it.
Major, that is an unholy abomination. You can't make a fluff-a-nutter sandwich with that.
She looked at the label skeptically.
Sir, it has the same ingredient, Major.
Do not mess with someone's childhood, I said with all seriousness. A scoop of fluff on top of a mug of hot chocolate on a cold day? Yum. Whatever that heinous imposter is in your hand there, we can't have it aboard this ship. How much did you get?
4 of these jars, she said with great weariness. I'll send it back down when the dropship is unloaded.
I don't want to risk contaminating the planet with that abomination. Could we toss it out an airlock and let it burn up in the atmosphere?
That suggestion was made only half-jokingly. This was all my fault.
The list I gave to Sims of items I wanted aboard the Dutchman only had 3 items on it, but Fluff was one of them. What I should have done was buy a couple of jars while I was home, but I couldn't see myself lugging them around in my suitcase. UNEF Command already thought I was too immature for command. Maybe I could ask my parents to send a care package to Wright-Patterson, or wherever Sims was loading the dropships.
I will take care of that, sir.
She turned and left with a wry smile. I never did find out if she'd really tossed them out an airlock. I also never did get a jar of real fluff. I wandered down to a cargo bay that had been set aside for Special Forces gear. Major Smythe was there with his Spec Ops team leaders, personally checking every single piece of equipment and making a list of the gear they still needed.
"Welcome aboard again, Colonel Bishop," Smythe said while snapping a salute.
I returned the salute, and that was the end of the saluting that would be required aboard the ship, except for formal ceremonies.
"Major Smythe," I pointed to his new rank insignia.
Now maybe I'm not saying this the right way, but I'm sorry that your Special Forces did not see much action on the last mission.
"Colonel, that is not a problem for us. We are here to provide an elite capability whenever that capability is needed. Special Forces are used to a lot of hurry-up-and-wait and clandestine missions when we are only needed if something goes very wrong. Most of the time, if the enemy knows that Special Forces have been in the area, we have failed our mission. On these missions, the enemy can't even know that we exist. We understand that the need to avoid exposure severely limits our ability to engage in combat operations."
"It severely limits our ability to do pretty much anything out here," I agreed.
"We will be..." He ejected a clip from a Krestang rifle, then set the rifle carefully on a rack.
"Seeing substantially more action on this mission?"
I nodded.
"According to Skippy, there is no alternative. Do you feel up to combat against the Theranin?
Against genetically enhanced cyborgs with superior technology?
My people will be ready, sir. Hopefully Skippy can give us some sort of an advantage."
"He doesn't think so," I said glumly. "But I'll talk with him."
I was in my cabin to change out of my formal uniform when Adams called me from the CIC.
"Colonel, we just received a message from UNEF Command."
"Go ahead," I answered, spitting out a mouthful of toothpaste. "Why did people always call when I was in the bathroom?" Talking while kneeling on the floor of a cramped Theranin bathroom seemed undignified, so I carefully stood up, wary of the low ceiling.
"NASA has telescopes watching that Krestang troopship, and they've picked up an increased infrared signature. Something out there is heating up, sir."
"Uh-huh. Thank you, Sergeant. I'm going to ask a certain shiny beer can what he knows about that." I ended the call on my Z-phone and looked at the speaker in the ceiling, knowing Skippy was always listening.
"Hey, Skippy, do you know anything about activity on that troop ship?
You monkeys noticed that, huh?"
"Apparently, yes. You're not trying to blow it up, are you?
Please, please say no."
"Not blowing it up, Joe. I'm restarting the reactor temporarily to get a partial charge for the ship's jump drive coils."
"You are planning to jump it somewhere?" I asked hopefully.
"Yes," he said with a sigh.
"I've been looking at the plans for the spacecraft you monkeys are building. It's like a can made from newspaper and cow manure, only less flightworthy.
I can't stand the idea of brave but idiotic astronauts making a long journey in that flimsy piece of crap. But I still don't want you monkeys whacking each other with sticks over that ship, so I'm jumping it halfway to your moon. Your nations will still need to cooperate to get above low Earth orbit."
"That is a nice surprise. Thank you, Skippy."
"Ah, don't mention it. The socks I bought you for your birthday are on back order, so I had to get you something else. A starship beats socks any day."
"But these were very nice socks, Joe, and I got you a card and everything."
I laughed. "That is very much appreciated. How about this? For my next birthday, I'll set up a gift registry and you can select something from the list."
Ooh, that's a good idea. I saw this in a movie."
Considering that Skippy had probably seen every movie ever made, that was not surprising. I tried to think of how many romantic comedies had a gift registry as part of the plot.
"It was The Wizard of Oz. For your gift, you want a brain, right?"
Crap. I walked right into that one, didn't I?
"Yeah, you did. If it had been a tree, you would have broken your nose."
"Thanks for keeping me alert, I guess.
When do you plan to jump that ship?"
"We jump out of here in 3 days, so I'll do it in 2 days. In case UNEF gets too excited as soon as the jump drive coils are charged sufficiently, I am shutting the reactor down again."
"They'll need to figure that out by themselves.
And tell your NASA that Dr. Friedlander is not available to get that troopship's reactor restarted. He started telling me a joke this morning, and he got interrupted. That rocket scientist weasel isn't going anywhere until he tells me the freaking punchline, Skippy grumbled. I will inform UNEF then. They will be very pleased. I do have one question first. Are you sure that bringing that ship back won't be seen as you caving in to UNEF? Huh? No, why would they think that? There was no quid pro quo here. Ugh, you don't understand Latin. I'll use language you can understand. I did not make a bargain with UNEF. I got everything I wanted and gave no concessions to them. Me bringing that ship back is a gift from the benevolent, all-powerful Skippy. Plain and simple. All right, then. Personally, I was afraid that UNEF would see this as me having influence on Skippy and being able to get him to do other things in the future. UNEF had better not get used to that. One more thing, then. Really? I bring you a starship and you want more? Unbelievable. This is simple, I promise. Fine, he huffed. What is it? That troop ship has a Kristang name, right? Some long-ass poetry thing? Correct. The Kristang traditionally named their troop carriers after soldiers who died particularly gloriously in battle. This one is called the Everlong Remembrance of Coast Vlacranda, who served with ultimate honor. Wow. This Coast guy, what did he do? Well, his family is well-connected in their clan, so naming the ship after him was partly political. He was a first son, and he died when his dropship got shot down. This was after he led a raid on another Kristang clan, a raid that resulted in the deaths of almost 3,000, including females and children. Also, there is suspicion he was drunk the day of that raid. My mouth opened to remark that Coast was no hero, when I remembered the Ruha whales that I had shot down. Almost 1,000 Ruha had died then. For that action, the Kristang had insisted that I be promoted to wear the Colonel's silver eagles that now adorned my uniform. I am certain the Ruha did not think I am any kind of hero. Skippy, I want you to rename that ship as the Yu-Kishan. Oh. Joe, it is not often that I say this, but in this case I completely agree with your suggestion. Sergeant Yu-Kishan of the Chinese Army had sacrificed himself to prevent a Kristang crewman from self-destructing the flower when we boarded that frigate near Paradise. Everything we had accomplished since then we owed to Yu-Kishan. Done. The official designation of the ship is now the Everlong Remembrance of Yu-Kishan, who served with ultimate honor. My intention had been to rename it as simply Yu-Kishan, but what Skippy did was better. Everyone was going to call it the Yu anyway. Thank you, Skippy. UNEF Command was indeed thrilled when I told them the U would soon be back in Earth orbit. They also congratulated me for persuading Skippy to cooperate, even though I told them several times that I had nothing to do with it. And I'm sure that somewhere, Chuckles the Clown was patting himself on the back for getting Skippy to do what UNEF wanted. Maybe in some way he was right about that. Maybe he hadn't manipulated Skippy into doing what UNEF wanted. Maybe Chuckles had manipulated me into getting Skippy to do UNEF's bidding. I didn't like that idea at all. What I did enjoy was telling Lieutenant Colonel Chang about renaming the troop ship. We had talked about honoring Sergeant Yu in some way, but hadn't done anything about it until now. Truthfully, we had been kinda, you know, busy. Chang was visibly affected by my gesture of renaming the ship. I thought I saw a tear in his eye. He later told me that he had called Yu's family personally to inform them of how UNEF was honoring their son. He did that before I told UNEF of the renaming, so that some idiot desk-bound bureaucrat at UNEF Command wouldn't be able to order me not to do it. One thing that being in the military had taught me is that it is better to act and ask forgiveness than to hesitate and ask permission. Chapter 6. Flying Dutchman. We finally jumped away from Earth orbit after only one or two minor delays. Before we initiated the jump sequence, Mr. Chotek wanted to give some sort of undoubtedly long-winded speech to the crew. He needed to assert himself as the mission commander or mark the momentous occasion in his special way or something, so I asked Skippy to open the intercom and a channel to UNEF Command on Earth. Sure, maybe I should have warned Chotek what was likely to happen. On the other hand, the best way to learn is through experience, and he was never going to forget this. So I actually did him a favor. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. What we on the bridge and in the CIC saw was Hans Chotek, wearing a dark blue suit, white shirt, and red tie. Why he felt the need to wear a suit was a mystery. My order for the uniform of the day was not formal, but the military personnel were all wearing uniforms, and I guess Chotek's work uniform was a suit. What we heard was Chotek clearing his throat and saying, "I would like to address the crew." Then he launched into a prepared speech about the importance of this mission and reminding people of our objectives. He was about halfway through the first objective when a Chinese pilot in the CIC snorted with laughter while she looked at a display screen. Then she stood straight up, trying to be serious. What the rest of the crew and people at UNEF Command on Earth saw and heard was not Hans Chotek in a suit. Through the video feed, they saw and heard Count Chocula, beginning with him saying, "I would like to address the crew," in an exaggerated movie vampire accent. The Count then proceeded to explain the importance of our mission to bring delicious chocolatey breakfast cereal to the children of the world, and how much Frankenberry cereal sucked by comparison. While talking, the Count picked a booger from his nose, tried to flick it away, then smeared it on his jacket lapel. Without even seeing the video, I had to bite my lip to keep from laughing while Chotek continued his speech. 2 minutes in, with him glaring at the crew in the CIC as they tried to suppress laughter, he was interrupted by Chang. "I'm sorry, Mr. Chotek, there is a..." Chang had to pause to collect himself. "There is a problem with the video and audio feed." "Problem?" Chotek asked, annoyed to be interrupted while giving